Thank you for coming. Thank you for being here at this late hour, and thank you for listening to me in English. So we cannot change the past, and we have to wait for the future. It may seem to us that we've always known this, but actually we haven't. The rules of causal transmission have changed radically in the last 100 years. In every distinct historical epoch, from ancient times to the present, our view of how we can or cannot access the past or the future has been tightly connected to particular technologies in use, and these are mainly communication and transportation technologies. It was actually Einstein who set the standards of our modern conception of temporality, and Henning referred to special relativity. In 1911, he said, one cannot telegraph into the past. So why not? Telegraphing into the past meant traveling faster than the speed of light. It meant having a messenger that was faster than causal transmission. So this messenger could overcome another one, a slower one, could intercept the message or the action that had been started. If this messenger existed, he could change the past, and he could actually kill his own grandparents, and this is called the grandfather paradox. But return to note the importance of the word telegraph in the phrase, one cannot telegraph into the past, and I will return to that. So in 1911, when Einstein said this, his theory was not widely embraced, and many readers, amongst them the philosopher Henri Bergson, believed that the physicist's notion of time did not fit at all with our actual experience of it. The two men met in 1922, and they had a debate where one of them stressed the objective nature of time and the other one the subjective nature, the human quality. These criticisms were heard far and wide, and they even affected Einstein never got the Nobel Prize for relativity. And the presenter of the award said that this was Bergson's fault. But one of the things that Bergson did in his critique of Einstein was that he disputed the fact that you could see these fictional tales that Einstein was telling about time travel and twins and time dilation, shrinking proportions. And he actually compared Einstein's talent to H.G. Wells, the science fiction author who had written The Time Machine in 1895. And in that book, he had considered time as a fourth dimension, 10 years before Einstein wrote the 1905 paper. So what I find very interesting is that 1 year after his debate with Bergson, Einstein felt compelled to intervene in a science fiction debate. And he took time off what was then a very busy schedule, he was already a very famous man, to write a preface to a science fiction book called The Stars in World History, or the Gestirne und Weltgeschichte. It was published in 1923 by an author called Felix Eberti. And Eberti described time travel scenarios, and he also described ways in which one could see the history of the world run backwards. So if you could travel faster than the speed of light and land in a star where our current light waves had not reached, you could actually see the world in a past state. He would say the example he used was at the time of Abraham. Was this popular science or science fiction? In fact, Felix Eberti's book had been considered popular science until Einstein wrote the preface to this book, and it had been taken by many authors in Germany, Aaron Bernstein, who wrote popular science books, extremely popular, that Einstein himself read. So as a grown-up, he decided to write the preface, and he said that not everything was possible because one could not travel faster than the speed of light. But a damage was done, and Einstein never got the prize for the work that made him famous. And a number of writers, including Gaston Bachelard, started poking fun at his fantastical examples. All the tales of passing trains, he said, of aviators who smoke cigars on lengthened and contracted periods of time. And he wondered what purpose they actually served. He concluded that modern science was more poetic than poetry had ever been. And there were many other thinkers who talked about and started laughing at these trains, revolving sidewalks, railway tracks, boundaries made of clocks, spaceship travelers, etc. Why were relativity's popularizing, allowing to give their imagination free rein in certain ways, but not in others? Eberty, one of the stories that he said that got retaken by Aaron Bernstein, and I'll read a quote. He said, he's describing a traveler that left the Earth and traveled faster than the speed of light. He said, in one point in space, the light of the scenes of the French Revolution is just coming into view. And even further away, the invasion of the barbarians has just become the order of the day. Alexander the Great is still conquering the world. And even further away in space, the representation of Earth's past by way of light will just be advancing into the future. Historical events that have long been dead for us will just be coming to life. So again, to give you a sense, this was considered popular science when it started, when they were first published in 1823. Then we have Einstein in 1911 saying one cannot telegraph into the past. And in 1923, he writes the preface to this book so that it comes, you know, with a trigger warning for students who read it. And in the preface it said, the theory of relativity saves us from these characteristic conclusions. So I'm retelling this episode of history to remind you just how recent and how contested our contemporary views about time travel are. In Einstein's time, the telegraph and electrodynamic technologies more generally, technologies of transportation and communication, were used as models for understanding causality more generally. Also think how he defined simultaneity. And he used this phrase, which is very famous and has been reprinted over and over again. He said, simultaneity is the pointing of the little hand of my watch to seven and the arrival of a train are simultaneous events. So it is not a coincidence that we find throughout Einstein's writings on time, telegraphs, wristwatches, light signaling metaphors, and of course, trains. These things provide the sort of material culture that determine our sense of the here and now, and the possibility or the impossibility of time travel. While we also see that many other thinkers have started to unpack this supposedly simple category of the here and now, and among them you can have, you know, you can count Walter Benjamin, Martin Heidegger, and also Derrida's critique of the metaphysics of presence is connected to unpacking this apparently self-evident category. I want to contrast this story with a period in the scientific revolution. And in order to give you a sense again of how our views of what is possible in terms of time travel are conditioned by particular material context. And this is Robert Hooke's Micrographia, and he's defending the use of the microscope. But he actually argues that the microscope can be an instrument for looking into the past. Because of how it enlarged certain samples, it revealed a new geological history of the Earth. So in Chris Marker's film, and I will now refer to that, one of the very stunning things that you will notice is that it is made mostly entirely from still photographs. So it breaks decisively with our view of cinematographic linear time that adds the images together with a machine in a sequence. And once you have the still photographs, you start to question our common way of understanding movement of the screen as cinematographic. And you start to think about the relation between narrative structures and standard techniques of representing causality and movement via machines, both the recorder and the projector. So one way of analyzing time in this film, and therefore its relation to the particular context in which it was made is through these binaries that also occupy very powerful roles in contemporary culture. The still versus the moving, the now versus the historical, Henning divided them in three parts, the symbolic versus the narrative, a salient moment, or also what Goethe would call a pregnant moment, versus any moment whatsoever that can be associated with Jules-Étienne Marais and later discussed by Gilles Deleuze. And I talked about these binaries yesterday, and it's something that I investigate in my book on Einstein and Bergson. But I would like to leave them behind and point to another way in which Chris Marker reveals temporality. And as you look at the movie after our presentations, I'd like to consider other aspects of markers of time which generally would not think have to do with time. And this one in particular has to do with the title of the movie, The Jetty, the jetty at which it's an Orly airport in Paris, and it serves as the launching pad for traveling across time, subjective and objective worlds from fiction to reality. But it's also the place of the main character's romantic encounter with, at some point, it's a woman that he loves, another point is his mother. And also, this is the image from an encounter in the Museum of Natural History. This is a place that collects specimens and preserves them through taxidermy, which gives us a sense of layered time. But again, like the jetty, it is a geographic location that's an encounter. What makes it important, I think, in the narrative is the encounter. And that is what makes it a launching pad for traveling in time. Marker's film shows us how we can travel in time despite the fact that the cinematographic machine, either using long takes of the documentary or highly edited and fictional films, are built on two very constraining notions of temporality, one that I generally associate with the Einsteinian and the other one with the Bergsonian. It actually makes us realize that average things like telegraphs, trains, elementary objects of everyday use, by virtue of our modern conception of temporality, or even in his case, in the airplane, the terminal, the museum, are essential tools for establishing time, but because they're places of communication and communion. The jetty at the airport is very powerful in the film. It's a place where we hurry or wait to meet someone. It is for that reason, and I'd look forward to getting your opinion on this in the discussion, but I believe that it is for that reason that it continues to be a place for time travel. He shows us why Einstein's redefinition of time also occurred at a jetty, at the train station. Go back to his phrase, the pointing of the little hand of my watch to 7 and the arrival of a train are simultaneous events. So I want to claim that this sentence became so important for physics, the sentence that revolutionized our notions of simultaneity, because of how it resonated with millions of passengers waiting eagerly at a station for someone to arrive. Thank you.